This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the long-awaited student assignment plan for CMS has been revealed. Now the work of explaining it begins. A judge on the North Carolina Court of Appeals resigns in protest of a new law reducing the size of the court. Beer brewers' efforts to expand go flat as the legislature sides with distributors. Two big banks in town hold very different shareholder meetings. And Dale Earnhardt Jr. prepares for a permanent pit stop. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more, and they are Tom Bullock and Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning.
Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Mary C. Curtis rounds out the panel. She's a columnist at Roll Call and contributed to other publications as well as to WCCB News Rising and NBC BLK. Hello to you.
Good morning.
And you can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or reach us through Twitter at charlottetalks using the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Gwendolyn, you have the lucky... So you've drawn the lucky straw to talk about the schools here this morning. CMS has been working on 2 years, as we've been talking about for 2 days now, a student assignment plan. Monstrously complicated task, monstrously complicated plan. It's bound to confuse people. It's bound to make some people unhappy, some people happier than others. And Ann Clark presented it to the school board on Tuesday. In case people missed our one-hour program on this yesterday with two school board members and two education reporters, you can hear it at WFAE.org. But you've been following this. What's the big takeaway here?
I would say you said it complicated. And they had a live Facebook event on this after the school board meeting. And one thing that, you know, is very complicated. Parents are confused in terms about the future of their schools. And when you look at all of this, it's just a lot of things moving around. Mm-hmm. And this isn't the end of it. As new schools come on board, they say they're going to make some more tweaks. So a lot of people are very confused and trying to wrap their head around this.
As the two school board members pointed out yesterday, when I asked why now, why are you doing this now? They said, well, every 6 years they have to take a look at this to make sure that they've balanced out their portfolio of schools. In other words, some schools become overcrowded in 6 years, some schools become underutilized, and of course this plan was to do that and also to break up these pockets of extreme poverty and to kind of find a way to unsegregate our resegregated schools. But this plan is being described by some school board members as conservative, meaning...
Well, the breaking up the high concentrations of poverty, that was one of the goals that this was, one of the goals that was supposed to drive this. But when you look at it, only 21 schools will show an improvement in terms of poverty. So that's why a lot of people are calling conservative, and some are saying they wish that they would have gone further in terms of this.
But 70, do you want to chime in?
Yeah, I was just going to say, and to be clear, that's 21 of 75 schools. Yeah. So if the
exactly.
number one, yeah, and it's a great point to bring up, Gwen, because if your number one driver here is trying to decrease concentrations of poverty, which directly affects kids and directly affects schools, one has to wonder why then only focus on, you know, have this effect on 21 schools. It is a small percentage of those that are changed.
And to give you an example, when you look at some of the schools that will be having some change because of overcrowding and whatever, you didn't see a big change at all in terms of what they're calling the social economic status. When you Bruns Academy, that's one that was in the pre-K group of schools, that they kind of pushed that because they had to make a decision on those pre-K schools. A lot of people wanted them to go back to elementary schools. But when you look at Bruns and Reed Park and Westerly, okay, they're going to make those elementary schools again. They're getting out of the pre-K through 8. But when you look at that social economic status of those schools, Reed Park is going to still have 100% low social economic status. And Westerly, I think, yeah, it will remain at 99% low social economic status. So when you look at numbers like that, some of them did change, but in cases like this, there's no change.
Mary.
Yeah, well, when we have neighborhoods that also are divided on socioeconomic status and you want children to stay in their neighborhoods, they're always going to be competing priorities, and you can't really make everyone happy. And so you are going to always have these problems as long as Charlotte itself is a city that's divided in this way.
And while they're taking some schools and making them full elementary schools again, they're taking other schools and pairing them so they will become K through 2 and then 3 through 5. And those schools are Nathaniel Alexander and Moorhead, Dilworth, yes, and Sedgefield, Billingsville and Cotswold. Have we heard any reaction about that?
Yes. I haven't heard from any parents, but in terms of those schools, yes, they are making, what they're trying to do is to say, okay, the students will stay together longer, that you will be together when you're in the K through second, and Nathaniel Alexander will be the K through second, and then 3 to 5, which Moorhead will be, mm-hmm, and you'll go to all the same middle school, and those students will go to James Martin School. Now, again, looking at the social economic status, which was one of the main driving forces, James Martin, once they go to middle school, you'll see some change there, 52% to 48% low. But when you look at Nathaniel Alexander, it will go from 64% low economic status to 45% medium, and Moorhead would go from 60% medium to 45% medium. And one thing, we don't know what's in the other part of those percentages. They didn't present it to us in terms of, okay, the rest of that, is it high, is it low, where is it? So it's a little hard to figure out.
And even the school board members don't know yet how many students this really affects overall, the plan overall.
Exactly.
One of the other things they're going to do is turn some magnet schools into partial magnet schools, meaning that they'll become partially neighborhood schools but also offer a magnet program. Why?
Well, they're saying they want to spread it around. Their rationale is that they want to open up more seats. When they do this, they're going to add a couple of thousand magnet seats countywide by 2018. So they're saying that by making some of these, and Moorhead, is a STEM school, it's one that will be a partial magnet. And they are going to open up more seats for neighborhood school students to get in the program. And they will still have, you know, the students will have their magnet courses, but others will be able to, you know, apply and get in. So they'll have more seats, and then they'll spread them around to other schools. But one thing, during the school board meeting, Erica Ellis Stewart brought up that, I think she said it was maybe about 6 years ago or a few years ago, that the Magnet School of America review, that when they came to look at how CMS was doing in terms of these partial magnets, they didn't get a very good grade, and they're felt that there was a lack of fidelity to the theme of what these magnet schools, whether it was arts, whether it was STEM or whatever, that these partial magnets were not performing well. And Ann Clark, Superintendent Ann Clark, did say that, yes, we have not done as well in the past, but what she was saying that now what we're going to do is attach these partial magnets to strong magnet programs where, say, for instance, Moorhead that has 1,200 waiting list.
This is so complex. A lot of people are still trying to absorb this, and even the school board doesn't understand the whole thing yet. They have to look at this. They're going to hold a series of meetings with parents, although they have a finite timeline because they have to
vote. The
first
one's on, what, the 9th of May?
Yeah, but they have. I think they have to vote by May 23rd on this plan because it goes into effect in 2018. And some of the overcrowding problems have to be dealt with by state law by 2018. So parents are still trying to get a handle on this. And in the Huntersville area, some parents were described as hysterical because of proposed boundary changes affecting Huff and Hopewell High Schools. And Dee Rankin is a parent of a student at Hopewell.
There's a certain stigma that I've heard among some parents that about Hopewell and Huff and comparing the two. I think it will create a better education environment for kids to experience other socioeconomic statuses.
So where there is concern, is it mostly centered around what the plan does to high school attendance zones? I mean, is that the big sticking point here? Because high school is a very emotional time of life for students and for parents.
I think in this case that Huff earned an A-plus state rating and Hopewell,
right,
had a rating of C. So I think a lot of parents are looking at their children going from an A school to a C school. And I think that's a big part of it. Also, Huff was overcrowded, so they're saying that they're doing this to make Hopewell more diverse, and also Hopewell had space that was not being utilized. So that's the district's explanation in terms of why they're doing this.
Yeah, and I have to say, honestly, this is a decision that directly affects my family. One of my daughters attends kindergarten at Grand Oak, and that is one of the schools that has moved from Huff to Hopewell. And talking to neighbors, talking to friends, just, you know, personal experience. My wife and I bought a house thinking about we really want to send our child to public school. You know, let's gear it towards the best public education she can find. Mm-hmm. I was talking to friends, as soon as this came out, that were just floored that this would happen. They're worried about the property values. They're worried about, you know, if they try to sell their home, will they get less or can they ask for less because they no longer have that A-plus high school at the end but a C school? And, you know, I do have to say that along with that initial, as you described it, hysteria, there is a bit of a calming down when people are like, okay, this is a shock. Let's wait and see what happens. And I do think that is an important step. This is not the end of everything. This could be a way to improve Hopewell. Yeah. This could be a way to improve the district overall, or if it's not implemented correctly, it could really turn out poorly.
But because this is so multi-layered, because it does impact people's property values and where they want to live, and if you've just bought a house because you've planned out your child's educational career for the next 16 years or whatever it is, 12 years, and suddenly the map changes. That's what surprised me yesterday when they said they do this every 6 years. I mean, that doesn't seem like – that seems awfully quick.
And they will, as I said, as new schools come on board, they will make additional adjustments, because some schools, people were saying, well why weren't these schools changed? And they said, well, because new schools are going to come on and we would have to change them again, so we didn't want to change them twice. But just to add about Hope and Huff and Hopewell, you have one other thing is that Huff is 75% white and 72% high social economic. Mm-hmm. And you have Hopewell, which is 28% white and 29% high SES. So
they're almost mirror image of each other.
To change that dynamic.
To follow up, Gwen, anything in Charlotte, you know, you talk about your property mm-hmm. and you talk about race. Mm-hmm. And that's always an underlying piece of pretty much anything here. And the city is changing. Folks who buy a house, it's in a way unrealistic to think 20 years down the road or 15 years down the road there will be no changes. But change is difficult.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have a series of meetings with citizens to talk this out. Is that the only way parents and others, concerned parties, can talk to the school board in advance of this or get questions answered about this plan? Because they may ultimately be okay with it if they understood it.
Well, they did have that Facebook event, so I don't know if they're going to do that again.
That's a one-shot deal in the middle of the day that wasn't well publicized.
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to do that again, but they're going to have community meetings throughout the city, as they did before they put this all together. They're going to have those community meetings, and then they'll have public hearings also at board meetings. So people will be able to ask questions at those times.
Okay. We're going to come back. We're going to try to have Superintendent Ann Clark on this program in the near future, because she is the one person in the known universe that understands this plan. When we come back, we'll talk about an appeals court judge taking early retirement, essentially, in protest. And also, it's crossover week in Raleigh. Maybe you haven't heard about this. Everybody, it's a big party. Everybody goes. They dress up.
It's late nights, but it's not a party.
Yeah. Yes, that's true.
It's sort of like square dancing.
Okay. Very square. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Steinway Piano Gallery, Charlotte, offering Boston and Essex pianos designed by Steinway & Sons, all ranges for all homes, located in Northlake Village, and online at SteinwayPGCH.com. And Baby & Company, a modern birth center offering individualized maternity and well-woman care, classes, and wellness services in an intimate setting. More information available at BabyAndCompany.com. Monday is May 1st. That's May Day. May Day seems a fitting time. term as a closer for the ongoing crisis at Wells Fargo. A message of dissatisfaction was loud and clear at a rowdy shareholder meeting, the first since the bogus accounts scandal broke. The new CEO says he's still working to right the wagon as new allegations emerge. And guest host Tom Bullock talks to two banking reporters and NPR's Chris Arnold, who just won the Peabody Award for coverage of the personal impact of the Wells scandal. That's all coming up on this program Monday at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, funding the government, an about-face on NAFTA, tax plans, sanctuary cities, Arkansas executions. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
A look at the week's top news continues after Charlotte Talks with On Point at 10. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News, along with Gwendolyn Glenn, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, and Nick Oxner, a reporter for WBTV. The legislature continues to be very active this session.
Whether we like it or not.
And for a second time this week, they have overridden a gubernatorial veto, this time on reducing the size of the Court of Appeals. And that has resulted in the, I don't know whether resignation is the right word or premature retirement is the right word, of a Republican member of the court, Judge Douglas McCullough. He retired earlier, if we want to use that term, because he was irritated by this law.
I watched the debate on that law very carefully. I saw that people who raised questions about it were brushed aside. One of our judges went to the Judiciary Committee meeting with the correct statistical information that showed that the statistics that they were putting out to the public to justify the so-called reduced workload was really erroneous. Four chief justices wrote a letter to every member of the General Assembly saying that this was going to be harmful to the court. And I watched each of these arguments being batted away or not acknowledged in any way.
So is he implying or actually saying the legislature is using erroneous information or alternative facts to make their case in the face of those who know the truth, the judges themselves?
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what he said. I mean, you heard it in the segment of the interview that you just played, and he really took a principled stance. And remember, this is a Republican, yes, a registered Republican judge, and this was one of the bills that was introduced by, I believe it was Representative Justin Burr, who admitted freely. I give him credit for this. He admitted freely on the floor of the North Carolina House that he neither sought nor received any guidance, information, or any help on the bill from any member of the court. In addition, not the North Carolina Bar Association, obviously didn't listen to the letters from the Supreme Court justices, and yet it passed, it was vetoed, and that veto was overridden. But what the judge that we just heard from did, which was really interesting, is he was just over a month from having to retire. At 72, you have to retire as a judge. 36 days away, thank you. And he said he couldn't, you know, he didn't want his legacy to be the diminishment of the court.
Why would that be his legacy? He had nothing to do with it.
But if he retired after the law was passed, his seat disappears. So by doing this early, it did two things. Number one, the important part for him was it kept that seat on the court. Number two, this was not important to him, it allowed Democratic Governor Roy Cooper to appoint a replacement who is a Democratic judge.
But that fact alone underscores just the big message Doug McCullough was trying to send here. And it's also, you know, when you talk about the caseload and the facts and figures that they used to pass this through, Representative Burr, who's been in the legislature a long time and knows a lot of what he's doing and when he talks, he does it generally knowledgeably. Yep. But he said publicly, we need to return our courts back to 1990s levels. Now, that's something that many in the judicial sphere has really taken issue with, because the caseload on the court has really increased.
So why does he want to return it to
1990s? Well, so this goes back to long history in North Carolina, because under the Democrats who controlled the legislature from Reconstruction up and through 2010, they expanded the court so that they could add more Democratic seats. And they also did away with party—
In the early 2000s.
That's correct. And they also did away with party affiliation when judges with R's next to their name started having more success in these judicial races. And so the Republicans aren't the first people to play politics with the court. They certainly are the most recent. I can tell you, as someone who's run statewide judicial races, there is a giant divide between the North Carolina judicial system and the North Carolina political system. Judges don't like to get political. The politicians like to pretend like they like the judges, but they don't really care. And so this is the result of two sides who don't really talk to each other.
Well, I do have to say there's one other thing here I would have to bring up. I don't think it's coincidental that all of this, these changes that are happening on multiple levels of North Carolina courts, happens after a Democrat defeats an incumbent Republican justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court, switching that body to a liberal majority rather than a conservative majority.
Well, and it's also no coincidence that this is all coming after the Republicans have been set a series of blows to some of their legislation mm-hmm. by three judge panels across the state. This is all very deliberate, and Republicans will really pretty much come out and tell you that they have been unhappy with the way the courts have been ruling on their legislation over the last couple years, and so they're setting out to make
changes. So Governor Cooper, score one for him. Did he outfox the legislature here?
No, he really didn't. Honestly, this all comes down to Judge McCullough. He's the one who did this. He knew the timing. There was a brief window between the governor's veto and when that veto was overridden. The Governor Cooper had no role in this, according to the judge, no role in this at all. This was a decision the judge made, and then it gave Cooper this brief window.
And the legislature didn't anticipate that the judge might be so upset that he would leave early and give an opportunity to the governor to appoint a Democratic judge.
They did. They knew. They but, did. But the time, you know, things
I don't moved. Think they thought he would do it.
I listened to his interview. It was very eloquent because you could hear him almost in pain. And it seemed as though he just really felt that, you know, that court has been praised overall. And he really had a sense of solidarity with his fellow judges. And he really, really was upset that when they were presented with facts that contradicted their own reasoning for the bill, that they basically ignored it.
And they're reducing it by attrition and retirements,
yeah.
Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the legislature overrode the governor's veto on this, which led to the resignation, which led to the appointment of this judge by the governor. Was this an attempt to reduce the governor's power or simply an attempt to change the a complexion, for lack of a better word, of the court?
Well, I'd say it's really an attempt to reduce the court's power. Mm-hmm. Because if you have fewer judges, that means you can either take fewer cases or you're doing even more shoddy work on the case on the same amount of caseload. This really has very little to do with the governor. It is an attack on the courts if you're going to look at it that way. And I don't think it's wrong to say that. But you have to remember, too, changing the makeup of the North Carolina Court of Appeals and allowing a full panel to sit en banc and hear cases for reconsideration only gets you so far when you still have a Supreme Court that has a majority of people with D's next to their name. And at the end of the day, because of really one ad in the last year's race for North Carolina Supreme Court, that's what we have. And the only justice that's up for re-election in 2018 is a Republican. And so without expanding the court, which we've heard rumors of this session, without expanding the court, the Republicans are still going to have to deal with the Democrat majority Supreme Court for the near future.
Okay, so they've been very, very, very busy in Raleigh in this session for a long time, but this was also crossover week. You did a big story on this morning on Morning Edition, Tom. Explain to folks who didn't hear that what crossover week is.
Aw, you listened. So crossover is, okay, here in North Carolina, officially, even though some years, does it not seem that it's the case, officially our state legislature is filled with part-time politicians. They're supposed to go off and have a day job and all of that. So crossover is an arbitrary date that is set by the chambers in order to make sure to basically say, look, a bill has to be passed by either the House or the Senate by this arbitrary date for it still to be considered alive. In theory and officially, if something isn't passed by that date, it is dead. Mm-hmm. But as we've seen in the past, almost like zombies, they rise from the grave and can be used by, you know, bills that seem dead can become amendments to bills that made it through crossover.
So, but because of this arbitrary deadline, there's a big scramble to get things done.
Huge, yeah. Yes. In fact, I actually lost count. Nick, you might have known this too, but I think it was something like 100 and – it was well over 100 bills were either passed by the House or the Senate combined.
I don't try to count because there are so many.
Yeah, in just the last week.
Let me ask a stupid question. Don't we have enough laws?
a lot of these are tweaks to, I mean, really, a lot of these are tweaks to laws, they're changes. But the interesting thing, too, so this date is very arbitrary, but the General Assembly this session has been dealing with two things. One, there was a really slow start to filing legislation. I mean, members were openly walking around for the first month or so saying, boy, no one's filing any bills. So that just means you're going to wait to the last minute to pass things that you want to get over to the other chamber. But two, as everyone remembers, and we had that other ugly word that I won't say on this program to deal with, that one bill that may or may not live in infamy.
The Voldemort bill,
yes,
apparently.
Yes, that's right, that we had to deal with and figure out that bathroom stuff. So that sucked a lot of air out of the room of important issues, and so that left lawmakers scrambling, you know, now to get all this stuff
Well,
done.
Let's talk about some of the bills, and this may have changed since I prepared this these series of questions for you, because a lot of things happened overnight. Let's talk about some of the bills that made it through.
Sure.
One of them, I think, is HB 514, which would allow the towns of Mint Hill and Matthews to operate their own charter schools. They have been rumored to want their own public school system. Is this the beginnings of that?
I think it's a trial balloon. I think it's giving them something now because, frankly, for them to be – they're obviously now in CMS. For them to become divorced from CMS would be a long, complicated, costly exercise. However, there was a bill that was passed that would actually look at the ability to shrink public schools, big school districts.
Yeah. House Bill 704.
There you go. You really did do your homework.
Yeah.
I give you credit.
You got your notes.
I'm trying to talk about HB 2. So.
Oh, he said it.
I got new numbers in front of me.
Yes. Yeah, so
I put money in the kitty now.
So, you know, Mint Hill and Matthews have not really been happy with the way things have been going on certain issues. And Matthews have been floating an idea of, right, well, maybe we should form our own school district. But this gives them a chance to start some charter schools where their students, their residents, I should say, get priority. It's not necessarily just always going to be filled with them, but they get priority in terms of attendance to those particular schools. And that would be a change because right now it would have to be open to all CMS.
And these charter schools, unlike some, would not be run by a corporation. They'd run by the actual towns?
Yes.
Okay.
And which almost makes a town like a de facto school district.
Yeah, absolutely. That 704 bill in the House would break up large school districts, and it specifically—
No, it would study.
Study the thought of breaking up large
school districts. Specifically aimed at Wake and Mecklenburg
counties. Yes, absolutely. And it's just a study bill, and I don't really think this has gotten a whole— you guys may disagree, but it's not really gotten a whole lot of opposition. It was proposed by Bill Brawley, Republican representative from Charlotte, and, you know, I think this is actually let's take a look at this problem. I don't know that this is going to result in any actual changes, but it could.
There's a Senate bill, 531, that would take away local school boards' rights to sue their county commissioners for more education funding. I don't know what the disposition of this, but this was put forth by somebody from Union County.
Surprise,
because they found themselves embroiled in that to the tune of $2 million, I think, right?
And that's funding between county school boards and boards of commissioners have always been a fight. You know, I'm from Fayetteville in Cumberland County. You know, we had that same fight years ago, too. And this really could handcuff school boards if this passes through the House. It's important to remember that when we talk about things passing, we're talking about one chamber or the other, and that means it can now be considered in the other.
Yeah, and these are not laws.
Yeah, and either enacted as it is or totally changed or fall by the wayside.
Okay. There are also several bills that would impact the rules of the road, and one is deals with protesters, and this grew out of, I think, the protests we had here this summer where protesters ran into traffic on interstate highways and also on local roads and got in front of cars.
And you are absolutely correct. And the bill's sponsor, the aforementioned Republican Representative Justin Burr, said as much multiple times during debate. This is House Bill 330. And this is fascinating and troubling. So the bill is brief. I mean, this is the copy of the entirety of it, and
even a full page.
No, and given what it does, if passed into law, what it would do, it's very interesting. Basically, what it says is, if a driver is driving their car and they just happen to hit or run over one or more protesters that are out in the street, that driver cannot be held criminally liable. They can't be sued for damages by the person that they injured. And what's fascinating is Justin Burr says, hey, this does not mean that people can just plow their cars into protesters. There's a phrase in this bill, that says drivers need to use due care, but there is no definition of what due care means. There is no explanation of the steps or even just the intention or anything. It is incredibly vague. And you know, there are all kinds of problems with this that even the people who ended up supporting the measure pointed out. I mean, there was an amendment to make sure that this was specific to protesters on the street because it could have been read in an earlier version that this would include
sidewalks.
People on sidwalks. Right. I mean, it says that, you know, this is only true if protesters don't have a permit
right.
to be on the street. But the United States Supreme Court has issued case law that says if people are reacting to something that just happened, they don't need a permit to be lawfully protesting on the street.
This is an example of a bill that may go to the Senate and either die or be substantially changed. I think this is the perfect
and
example.
Absolutely true, but it's also given the particular bent of some people in the Senate could also go through. I mean, we can talk about nips and tucks, but yeah. this
tend
has
to be
a chance.
A little more rational than the House.
It seems like another one of these bills is going to end up in the court. What is due care? It's as though, you know, I thought my life was in danger. it's so vague. And you can see someone, you know, who is just upset at the protest going in and maybe nudging someone. And it just is going to cause more escalations of tensions. And it seems like the legislature, they're doing all these bills that it's not really about laws and things that are going to advance the state, but more about policy and political partisanship. And when they all end up in the court, you wonder, my goodness, it's just going to get stalled.
Gwen.
And being out during those protests and hearing people who were angry and saying those protesters are in the street, I need to get home and things like this. And you saw the anger, and I actually heard people who were saying things like that, you know, just plow through them. And as you said, troubling. That is the troubling part. If they say, well, the law is out there that says I can't be sued, then that anger, they might actually act on it, and that is
I didn't mean to
troubling.
Hurt him. You know, I didn't mean to hurt him, but in the heat of the moment, we've all seen it.
Or if you feel threatened. I mean, if they're carrying sticks and they're hitting your car, you may feel in danger.
Yeah, which we're doing.
But here's the thing. I mean, you could let's assume mm-hmm. that was part of the motivation in this bill. It's not listed in the bill. There is no reference to whether or not you feel threatened. There is no exception for, say, if someone is seeking medical attention. I'm going to use an admittedly, you know, out there example, but let's just say someone really, really wants a Diet Coke and they're trying to get to 7-Eleven. And yes, I know I'm using an extreme example, but honestly, there is no differentiation between that mm-hmm. and someone who is, let's say, you know, a woman who's in labor and needs to get to an emergency room.
And I was at those protests too, and a lot of them, there were families there.
Mm-hmm.
So people have brought their children.
Yeah.
This could really cause some total difficulties.
Okay, so one of the other bills that affects the rules of the road had to do with the requirement that motorcyclists wear helmets. Is that one of the ones that died?
It's interesting choice of words since we're talking about motorcycle helmets, but yes.
Sorry about that. And the other would target slow drivers traveling in the left
lane.
Yes.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Uh-oh.
But it got a no vote. Actually, it didn't. It's basically dead. But this is actually a really good example of ways things can be resurrected, because Jeff Tart, I believe you talked to the News and Observer about this, but Senator Jeff Tart basically said it's okay that my bill didn't pass because we can actually add it on to another one that dealt with funding for driver's ed programs to teach people how to react to police when they get stopped. And therefore, that could come back.
You can always tuck it in the budget.
So we have another body cam story that we'll talk about when we come back, which resulted in a reversal, actually, by the police chief in terms of what he thought was justified one day and not justified the next day. We'll come back and talk about that in other stories as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Core 365, directly serving Charlotte organizations since 2008 and offering comprehensive information solutions, including document scanning and shredding. Detailed information at cor365.com. And Historic South End, presenting Art and Soul of the South End, Saturday, noon to 9 p.m., featuring live music, art, and free trolley tours. HistoricSouthEnd.com. Coming up as the news roundup continues on point, topics include funding the government, an about face on NAFTA, tax plans, sanctuary cities, Arkansas executions. That's all coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point with Tom Ashbrook. And we're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
This is a day to focus on the contradictions of Venezuela. It's an oil-rich country where it can be hard to find toilet paper. A country filled with...
It's your community. We help you understand it.
All the attention to asbestos in Davidson began last fall when a Charlotte developer held a public meeting about...
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup, and that is why we have all these people in the studio who are news people. Tom Bullock is on your right as you look at the radio dial. Gwendolyn Glenn is on your left. Right in front of me is Mary C. Curtis. And, of course, Nick Oxner is on your side.
You are just full of puns today.
Groan and groan.
All right. You reported this week, Nick, on a CMPD story of CMPD defending the actions of four officers caught on camera punching and elbowing an unarmed suspect in the head and other places, putting a gun to his head, actually. This took place last month. What happened?
No, this took place in March of 2016.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
Yeah. So a man named James Yarbrough was a passenger in a vehicle that police stopped because they thought that vehicle may be connected to a series of larcenies. Its license plate hit on a license plate reader. So they do a traffic stop. James Yarbrough, who is a three-time convicted felon, runs from police, and then they tackle him to the ground, and that's where a violent encounter ensues.
So let's and these never play well, as the chief pointed out, when you look at these body cam videos of takedowns. But here's a short clip of the audio from one of the body cams after the officer had Yarbrough on the ground.
Resist!
Okay, I'm not.
Stop!
I will kill you.
You understand?
Yeah,
give me your hand now!
Now!
And now Yarbrough, as the body cam video shows, and this goes on for a long time, he resists police after running from them for nearly 4.5 minutes, according to the time clock on the video. But you spoke with James Yarbrough.
The only thing I did wrong that day was run. That is the only thing I did wrong that day. That moment felt like, you know, it felt like it might have been my last day.
So why did he run, and did he tell you why he resisted?
Yeah, so, well, James Yarbrough denies that he resisted police. He says he has a medical condition in his neck, so when they tackled him on the ground, he was trying to get his arms behind him, but he was also in pain. He says he ran because he knew there was a gun in the car. The guy who was giving him a ride, he said, had just been trying to sell him a weapon. James Yarbrough, a three-time convicted felon for gun charges, basically said, I'd rather get a charge for running from the cops than stuck with a weapons charge for a gun that isn't mine. He was charged with possession of a weapon later, and that was dismissed by the DA's office for lack of evidence. But so he says he ran. The foot chase lasted about 3 minutes, and then he's caught by police. They tackle him to the ground, and where you hear the officer tell him to stop bleeping resisting, and then when the officer says, I will kill you, at that moment, the police officer, an officer named John Dunham, who then was a CMPD officer, has his pistol to James Yarbrough's temple and says, I will kill you. They had been on the ground for 17 seconds when he puts the pistol to his head.
So the video shows this. You can see it very quickly in the video. And CMPD Major Stella Patterson, who leads the department's internal affairs division, said a couple of days ago that this was justified.
When you look completely at the totality of circumstances, you have to ask yourself, was that reasonable in that situation? And based on everything, it was reasonable.
And initially, CMPD Chief Kirk Putney agreed with that, but yesterday he reversed that opinion.
I'm not going to defend some of the language because we do have policies that restrict what can be said and in what manner. Nor am I going to defend all of the tactics used, especially on behalf of Officer Dunham.
That is a very big reversal. And more, Stella Patterson, really, most of our interview answered the questions. She's the major over CMPD's Internal Affairs Division. And so she was answering the majority of those questions. Is it legally okay for him to have used his weapon? Is it legally okay for him to have struck James Yarbrough? But she also said, I asked her specifically, you and the department stand behind the officer's behavior. And that's a different question than the legal standard. And she said, yes, we do. Now, Chief Putney came out yesterday and said, I would never defend that behavior. No one in the department would ever defend that behavior. And when I asked him why he was reversing and changing course, he said he wasn't. And I think that's just factually inaccurate.
The officer now works, involved in this, now works in Davidson as a police officer. And I believe the Davidson police chief has taken a look at this. And what is her conclusion on that?
Well, so it's important to note that Davidson police was unaware of this incident. So Officer Dunham had applied to the Davidson PD before this incident. He had given them a waiver to go look at his IA file here at CMPD. They did that, but apparently they didn't do it again before he took employment, and which apparently is a responsibility incumbent upon the hiring agency to go back and do. And so because of that, they were totally unaware of this incident. The Charlotte Observer reported in their article yesterday afternoon that the Davidson police now say, after looking to the video, they spoke to me initially, but then declined to issue me a statement and stop talking to me. But yesterday, a spokeswoman for the Davidson police told the Observer that they now feel that Officer Dunham was justified in his actions.
So getting body cam video and dash cam video has been traditionally difficult, and it's been made more difficult because of a law that was passed late last year that makes it almost impossible to get it. How did you get this video?
Well, the law makes this video secret. That's a problem. This video that we have and we invest millions of dollars in equipment to record is secret under the law that was passed last year. We got this video because James Yarbrough called us and gave us a copy of this video because he wanted this story out there. And he wanted this story out there because CMPD had not done what it was required to do in properly adjudicating his complaints. He made a complaint to CMPD, and when a citizen complains about a police officer's action, there's supposed to be an IA investigation, and then that the conclusion of that investigation, they're supposed to give a written copy of their findings to the complaining citizen, who can then appeal to the Citizens Review Board. That did not happen in this instance. James Yarbrough was ignored for more than a year, so he came to us. And yesterday afternoon, in a new development, Chief Putney said that this investigation had just completed adjudication, although he couldn't give me a date when it was finished, had recently been adjudicated, and they would be giving Mr. Yarbrough his written summary of their findings so that he can file an appeal with the Citizens Review Board.
This could have ended very badly. Mm-hmm. It did not end very badly, but is this the end of it? Will Mr. Yarbrough, I know he's talked to an attorney who specializes in cases involving claims of excessive force. Is he going to file a claim, or do you know?
I think he is still evaluating his options, and I think I get the sense from speaking with him both before we did the story and after we did the story, he just wanted someone held accountable. And I think at the end of the day, he's happy that that has happened.
Speaking of holding people accountable, there were two shareholder meetings this week at the big banks, Bank of America and Wells Fargo. The Bank of America had a sunny and sunshine and rainbows atmosphere, where all the boards of directors were voted back in, and Brian Moynihan got to keep both the chairmanship and his CEO title. But something else happened at the Wells Fargo meeting.
Yes, all of the board members were reelected.
Yes, how about that?
No, so they're...
Barely.
But by small margins.
Well, some by small margins, others by 99%. No, you know you're in trouble when you're a bank and at your annual shareholder meeting, not only do you get chewed out by a nun, and yes, that really happened, but then she gets interrupted by another protester for not chewing you out enough. And that's basically what went down with Wells Fargo. This obviously revolves around, you know, the account scandal that we've talked about. And there was a big call by a major investment group that all of Wells Fargo's the members of their board should be voted out.
And why didn't that happen?
Shareholders decided not to. And you know, part of it, I think, is the fact that the independent members of the Wells Fargo board, which is always a kind of a cloaked term to me because all of them are officially listed as independent, they did issue and launch this independent report about the more than 2 million or around 2 million accounts that were created without customers' knowledge or approval in some cases in order to artificially boost Wells' share price and sales numbers. And People are really upset about that. The bank has already paid $185 million in fines, but there are a number of investigations that continue in this. And, you know, I don't think this is the end of it for Wells by any stretch.
And when you look at even Sanger, he is the chairman, correct?
Mm-hmm.
He only got about 56% of the vote. And on Capitol Hill, you still have Elizabeth Warren, who has a new book out that looks at a lot of what happened with Wells Fargo and is very critical of all of those bogus accounts. And she is calling for the ouster of the directors. And she's also calling, she called this week for a criminal investigation by the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm. Because I think there were four shareholders who were very loud about this. They wanted to know what the directors knew, when, and how much they knew, et cetera.
Yeah, and one of those is actually from a group that's called the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, which is a nonprofit that's based up in Boston. And they're there basically to help people with refinance mortgages that stem back to the predatory lending
right.
and dubious mortgages of the Great Recession.
Well, back to Raleigh, because they were busy this week flattening beer. The craft beer brewers had wanted to raise their production caps from 25,000 higher, and the number floated was 200,000. They weren't necessarily asking for that, but that was the number being floated, and it looked like House Bill 500 would achieve that. But at the last minute, all of the language talking about cap raising the cap was stripped out of the bill, and that's the end of that. And the two local brewers here, Old Mecklenburg and Noda, were the ones pushing this with some help from others around the state. So is this an example? They say this is an example of big moneyed special interests pulling all the strings in Raleigh. Is it?
No, they're not wrong. There continues to be, though, a fundamental divide amongst Republicans in the General Assembly, though, over this issue. Some Republicans, the ones who opposed House Bill 500 and the cap and raising the cap, say, look, these brewers, these craft brewers, when they opened, knew what the rules were. They need to follow the rules just like everybody else, and that's fine. And then you have those who say, I'm for small business, I'm for growth.
And for free market.
Well, that too. And I think these rules are arbitrary and dumb, so let's raise the cap. Ultimately, though, the distributors, you have to remember that there are, you know, a handful of beer distributors in the state of North Carolina that have basically monopolies over who gets, you know, who sells Budweiser and Coors. And those guys have a lot of money, and they've been making a lot of political contributions for more than a decade before OMB was even around.
Go ahead.
Oh, and I was going to say, I read this interesting article because this isn't a problem that brewers are having in North Carolina. It's all over the country. And in Colorado, you have some brewers who are putting their breweries on farms, and they are mailing their beer directly to people. And also in Massachusetts, they have what's called a farmer's brewer license, which allows farmers to sell directly to consumers. So breweries and brewers are finding ways to get around these very strict laws.
And there are provisions about farm breweries that got into the amended House Bill 500 that did pass.
And there are jobs involved in this, because Old Mecklenburg was planning to build a $10 million expansion up in, I think, Cornelius. Which they won't do now because they're almost at the 20,000 barrel cap.
They haven't officially said that they won't, but really this boils down to math. And it was explained to me pretty well by Ryan Self, who is their director of sales, and he said quite simply, if we go ahead with that project, math dictates that either we sell beer there, but that would also mean that we have to stop selling to some existing customers
right.
because we only have set amount we can make.
Right. We had the founders of Old Mecklenburg and Noda on this program earlier this week, and we invited Tim Kent, who is the CEO of the North Carolina Beer and Wine Wholesalers Association, to join us, but he said he had a commitment. And it turns out he did, because during the program, he tweeted this. While you guys were doing a radio interview, we were pretty busy today passing legislation. HB 500 wins House approval 95-25. Now, I know that when you drink beer, you want salty things around, but I don't know that you want to rub salt in the wound, which is what that sounds like to me.
I'll leave it with that.
Okay. Now, we always like to include a sports story at the end of this program because everybody around the table is so eager to talk about them.
Well, public radio is known
now.
For it.
Hey, now.
And this is the story about the end of the career of one of NASCAR's brightest stars, Dale Earnhardt Jr. He's slowing down, entering the final turn, pulling in for a final pit stop, dropping the red flag, hitting the brakes, turning in his car keys. In
you do,
short,
you do know her. It's not the red flag. It's the checkered flag.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah.
He's no, I don't know that.
Making
but now
Nick's
I do.
Point for him.
That's
caution,
right.
In caution short, ahead. Right.
In short, he's retiring.
Time to understand what's important to me. Time to realize the incredible support system I have in my wife, my team, and my doctors. And time to work like hell to wrestle back some semblance of say-so in this whole matter.
Now, he suffered a series of concussions in this last past season. So is that what drove this decision?
Yeah. And he's just married and, I mean...
He's 42. He's won 26 times on NASCAR's top circuit, but he told NPR on Weekend Edition a couple of Sundays ago that this last concussion has changed his life. He said, I'm certainly more aware, whether I want to be or not, of how dangerous race car driving is. So what does this mean for NASCAR? Because he's their brightest star.
He really is. And not just because his father was famous as well. He has his own personality, his own following. This is going to be not great news for NASCAR. And also, you know, he stepped out. He, remember, said that he did not agree with the Confederate flag flying after Charleston, which, you know, made a lot of the fans of NASCAR upset. He's his own person, his own sense of humor, and I got to give it to anyone who's going to go into the same sport with the same name as a legendary dad.
And Travis Parsons, the Dale Jr. fan, was outside Hendrick Racing headquarters during his retirement announcement, and here's how he took the news.
There's still plenty of stars out there, but, you know, it's just going to be a little missing piece, and somebody will fill it in.
There you go. Keeping the seat warm for the next driver. Well, Mayor Roberts believes that Charlotte needs an anthem, and she started a contest to find one. The finalists performed earlier this week at the Underground, where judges chose the winner, who will now go on to perform at the National League of Cities Conference in Charlotte this November. And although he mentions another radio station in the song, we're going to play a portion of the winning entry. Here's Jason Harkless, a.k.a. Jay Quinn.
Charlotte. Charlotte. Somebody tell me who you doing for. Charlotte. Game time, who you rooting for. Charlotte. Big city, bright lights, this is Charlotte. Hands up, everybody scream. Charlotte. I'm coming straight up out the Carolinas, Queen City, where y'all can see them. Bringing a crowd like the Bojangles Coliseum. I might catch a hockey game to see the Checkers play. In February, it's the CIAA. Yes. 1768, that's when it started. R.I.P. to the late, great Sophia Charlotte. Half a center trying to find myself a bar, but it's gonna take 30 minutes. Y'all know I'm coming from Albemarle. You know that uptown traffic stay live. Coming from 85, 77, 485. Bumper to bumper, you know it's 5 o'clock. Bumping power 98 and 92.7 the block. Charlotte, Charlotte, Charlotte.